some football!
Oh, intermission.
No, it's halftime.
Here comes Beckett. Down goes Shaw. The ball is out. Arkansas's got it at the 1 foot line.
Blue!
Yes, sir.
Do you trust that I do not want to see you die here tonight?
Sir, yes, sir.
Blue, you're my boy!
You can actually feel Razorback Stadium shaking underneath our feet right now.
I don't want them to gain another yard.
Here's the God in football.
Can't wait. The next game, and the years to come, because victory is going to be habitual.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
There are things to be excited about right now. I think the Arkansas offense is about to have a great few weeks. Ty Story looks like a real leader. He's throwing the ball very well now, shows presence in the pocket, and part of that has to be comfort level with Chad Morris's offense, even though it's just 30% installed. The personnel around him, I think, is more what Ty seems the most comfortable with. And after a suspension, Cheyenne O'Grady looks like one of the premier playmaking tight ends in the SEC, perhaps. Rakeem Boyd looks good. Devwell Whaley is coming back. Davion Warren making plays. The O-line generating some room. And for a coach that hangs his hat on offense, it took Chad Morris a while to get there with this group, and there's certainly a lot of room to improve for sure, but it appears that the Arkansas offensive unit is ready to turn a corner. And this week is the perfect time to begin getting around that corner with a very subpar Ole Miss defensive unit that allows the second most points in the SEC at 35.5 per game. They've been gashed on the ground. They've been gashed in the air. And honestly, it would be a disappointment if the Hogs don't surpass their numbers from a few days ago against Alabama. Anyway, a lot of college football talk today. We've got Bill King from Nashville Sports Radio joining us, bottom of hour number two. Your phone calls as well. You can get a hold of us as always at 877-377-6963. We're also going to be talking some baseball, not just to the major league variety, but college baseball with head coach of the Razorbacks, Dave Van Horn, scheduled to join us at the bottom of this hour. So it is a packed show, and if you want to get in with us right now. Again, that's 877-377-6963. My co-host is Ty Richardson. Good afternoon, Ty. How's it going today?
Good afternoon, Phil. I'd have to say we probably are the problem, though. I mean, the fact is Arkansas's 0-5 since we started our show, so I think we're the ones to blame, unfortunately, and I think that's only going to continue as we're on the air. So the more this show prolongs, the more the Razorbacks are going to lose, and that's going to, I guess, continue on Saturday.
They must just be crushing us on the message boards. They're absolutely killing us on Twitter. They're calling for our jobs already before we've even been able to get this thing really fully going, right?
Oh, haven't you read Hogville and Whoopig? They've been doing that since day one. Everyone wants you. You're going to lose your baseball job because of me and because of the station, because since we've been on air, since we've been doing the show, since halftime has started, Arkansas is 0-5, so we are 100% to blame. If you want someone to blame, don't blame Chad Morris. Don't blame Joe Craddock. Don't blame John Chavis. It's 100% on Phil Elson and Ty Richardson.
Well, our shoulders are broad enough to handle any sort of criticism about the football team that comes up. We might be a little bit sensitive on critiques of the actual show, but if you want to blame us for Arkansas losing football games, we'll take that blame. I'm fine with that. Once we get to baseball season, though, don't start blaming me for any losses for the baseball team. I'll take him for football since I'm not really connected to the team, but you cannot blame me for anything involving baseball losses. These are actual arguments that I've gotten into with friends and fellow broadcasters, and on occasion I question whether or not I should bring this out publicly, but I will never get into a Twitter war with anyone, a public Twitter war. But there have been a couple of direct messages coming from folks who blamed me for the loss of a no-hitter or the loss of a game when Arkansas had a lead in late innings. So, I mean, hey, people want to believe what they want to believe. And I say, if you're coming at me with that stuff, you better come hard, and you better be ready for a little blowback. There is no such thing as a broadcaster jinx. There never has been.
No, and I get enough crap from my friends and family, so I'm used to it by this extent. Now, maybe not to the extent that you've gotten it, but part of being in this industry is being able to take flack, being able to take not constructive criticism, actual criticism. So that's part of the fun, though. If you can't make fun of yourself and laugh at yourself a little bit, in sports media, then you need to get a new job. And I get there's certain self-esteem issues, there's certain self-confidence issues, and there's certain times that fans and sports media members go too far. But if you can't joke, and I've noticed this with doing a little remote with you, I can have fun with you, and I can mess with you a little bit, and you're not going to cry after the show or get mad at me after the show. That's part of this.
I'm going to cry, all right, but I'm going to do it when you're not looking.
Just off air. Okay.
Yeah, you won't see it happening. I'll crawl behind a couch and lay down and put a wet towel over my eyes so it can soak up the tears. And it hurts every once in a while, Ty, but you'll never be able to see that hurt on my face.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, Phil. That's the mindset you have to have in this industry, because if everyone complained about everything that was said to them on social media, then it would just be a circus. It already is enough of a circus, but we don't want to take it to a circus that we can't handle.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that something that is said on a broadcast or a telecast, that it translates to anything happening on the field is just flat out moronic, to be quite honest with you. But I also don't think that I am stepping out on that much of a limb when you're looking at what's ahead for the Razorbacks, certainly for the rest of this month. It looked like they already did start to turn the corner offensively against Alabama. They're not around that corner all the way. There's still a ways to go around that corner or around the mountain she comes. But against Ole Miss and then Tulsa and then Vanderbilt, neither of which are stout defensive teams in any fashion, whether on the ground or in the air, this is the time to really start getting a rhythm going on offense. Because then when you get into November and LSU and Mississippi State are on the schedule, those are two very good defensive teams. This is the time to get that rhythm, to get that feel and the confidence, and maybe install more of the offense. What Chad Morris talked about a couple of days ago, that they're 30% installed. Maybe the next 3 weeks with Ty playing as well as he has, you got that offensive line now lined up the way I think that you wanted to have it at the start of the season, and they're finally playing together for the last three or four games. You got some other playmakers that are emerging, and it really does seem now's the time to get that rhythm going, because once you get into November, you're facing much better defenses.
Yeah, and the argument can be made at the beginning part of the season when you go Eastern Illinois, Colorado State, North Texas was the easiest part of your schedule. But if you really dive into it, think about how many first-year coaches struggle early on, not just early first or second season, but right smack dab at the beginning of their coaching career. Now you've started to establish yourself a little bit on the offensive side of the football, which Chad Morris is what he's known for. The defense, though, it took a step back last week. You're hoping John Chavis can muster up what he did against Texas A&M and parts of what they did against Auburn. So now, looking at this schedule, I mean, Ole Miss, that's a very winnable ball game. One of the worst, excuse me, the worst defense in the SEC. The top worst defense in the SEC. And then you got a very winnable game against Tulsa, who under Gus Malzahn was pretty solid back in the day. They've had some other good teams, but the Golden Hurricane, not good this year. That should be a win. So if you can squeak one out in Little Rock, you get one against Tulsa, and then Vanderbilt, who's probably top three worst team in the SEC, along with Arkansas and Tennessee, and you could possibly throw someone else in there depending on where you want to look. But those are the three worst teams in the SEC, so you're digging in the bottom of the barrel. You win that, Vandy's never been good on the road to begin with, and Derek Mason and his squad don't look potent on either side of the football. Now, Kyle Shermer's a good quarterback, but they seem to always choke away the games they can almost win. That's three wins right there, and you're at four wins. You're 4-5 if you can squeeze them out. Now, I'm not going to say they're going to do that, but looking at it, it's not as difficult a task you would have thought a couple weeks before, when you lost to Colorado State and you got blown out by North Texas.
A couple of things that I think to me stand out as to why the offense looks better right now. And one of them is just the idea that Cheyenne O'Grady is playing. And it looks like Chad Morris and Joe Craddock are very interested in getting not just O'Grady, but the tight end position involved and using the athleticism that was there at the tight end position when they came in this year to their advantage. And the other thing is, you know, it's Chad Morris's first year as a head coach at Arkansas. There's a lot of firsts out there, too. Rakim Boyd hadn't played very much. He's now getting the ball a lot more. Ty Story, first-time starter, and now looking over the last 3 weeks like he belongs in the SEC. I think these aspects are big reasons why the offense struggled a little bit early. And now there's a connection between Ty and O'Grady. He seems to hit him in stride. O'Grady's got that great size, great speed, and he really does look like the sort of playmaking tight end that this offense needs. Now you're looking for maybe a few more plays from your wide receivers and the ability to get behind the defense. That's one thing I'll be looking for against Ole Miss and Little Rock, is whether or not those wide receivers can get past defensive backs. Ole Miss has, they're banged up defensively, especially in the secondary. And then the other thing that we'd question too, and this has been the most limiting part of Arkansas's offense, is the deep ball, because, you know, Story has been accurate. He doesn't quite have that arm strength to throw the deep ball so often, but I think you'd like to see more plays from the wide receivers, because you're getting more plays from running backs and from tight ends, not so much from the receivers.
Yeah, 17 catches for wide receivers and tight ends combined last game. We're really going to get into what they did offensively next segment. I don't know if Ty Story is ever going to earn the respect of his teammates for his talent, but he sure has for his toughness. I mean, he's stuck in there. You think about that Auburn game. He looked like Tyler Wilson 2012, Austin Allen 2016, 2017, how he was constantly pelted from Auburn defenders. And on his back, you saw his jersey after the game was covered in grass. And you just got to wonder, you only gave up one sack against Alabama. We didn't even mention that on Monday. You gave up one sack to Alabama. I have to go back and look the last time you gave up that few sack, that few number. And it really, there wasn't a lot of pressures. And I will say this, I don't know if Saban and company brought a lot of blitzes because they thought they could get to the quarterback, four-man, five-man front. But you have to give some credit to the offensive line there. And for Story, instead of just throwing the ball away or taking a sack, he made a lot of plays where he stepped up in the pocket and made some big throws. That was his best game of the season. I know the stats will tell you Eastern Illinois was, but if you look at that game, that was his best game of the season, Phil.
You bring up an interesting idea here about Story's teammates respecting him. Teammates respect toughness over talent. They respect poise over talent more than anything. They respect resilience over talent. And I think that there's a case to be made that sometimes the most talented players on a club, if it doesn't translate to the field, they turn out to be the least respected players on a team. In fact, there's nothing that will anger a coach, or I think fans or teammates, than an extremely talented athlete that doesn't translate to the field, more than anything because of a lack of hard work or a poor attitude or the idea that talent alone is going to get you where you want to go, which we all know is not the case. And you're seeing, I think you can even see in Ty's face during the game. I mean, you see the up-close shots during the game. We're seeing him at the post-game press conferences in his face and his countenance, the way he talks. And then the way he handles the offense during the game, you're seeing this is a quarterback who's becoming much more confident game after game, and I think part of that confidence is starting to filter out to the rest of his unit on the offensive side. I don't know if that translates to the defensive side, but you can see the rest of that offensive unit is they're not playing necessarily just like Ty, but I think they see this attitude that he's got, and I think that's the sort of quarterback that you want to play for, and that's what you need out of a quarterback to set that example.
Yeah, make no mistake, the SEC is probably the most difficult conference to play quarterback in, and even at Arkansas, you look at who he's following a guy like Austin Allen, who wasn't given the credit that he deserved. Same with his brother Brandon. Then go back to Tyler Wilson. Then go back to Ryan Mallett. Then go back to Matt Jones, Clint Sterner. I could keep this thing going for a while. It's not called quarterback U. Arkansas is probably never going to be given that label. But there's been some pretty solid quarterbacks that have come through the ranks of Fayetteville, Arkansas. So when you enter that position, there's some pressure on you, especially as a hometown kid, a highly profile, highly recruited kid, four-star coming out of Charleston. And he didn't live up to expectations at first. And I don't know if he ever will, what some people, especially in Charleston, thought he could be at Arkansas. But for him to have the tenacity, for him to have the intensity that he's had in these last few games, especially in the Auburn game where he could have mailed it in, he could have said, I'm done. I'm sick of taking this beating. I'm sick of getting drilled. I'm just going to mail it in. He didn't do that, Phil. And he came back and had the best game of his career so far against Alabama after the Texas A&M game, where he threw a losing pick, kind of like Austin Allen did 2 years prior. So it doesn't seem like there's quit in this kid. And as Chad Morris, Joe Craddock, you got to look at it and say, well, you don't have the most talent on the team. You're probably not going to be the quarterback of the future where we want to take this program to new heights, but you're sure a good placeholder right now.
Well, and there's no doubt Ty doesn't look at himself as a placeholder. He wants to play next year, too. And, you know, now into the context of this week, the improvement, the moral victories, all that stuff we've talked about these last 4 weeks, the baby steps forward, all that has to come to an end here. Not the improvement, but the idea that we're looking for positives within the context of a large negative, that negative being a loss each of the last five Saturdays. It's time to get a W. It's time to get a dub against an FBS team, which hasn't happened now in, what, nine games. It's time for Arkansas fans to not have to celebrate success on one side of the ball or on the other side of the ball or on one drive or on a couple of plays here and there. What they're craving is a win, a real win over an SEC team. And it really does. It has to start this weekend. There are no moral victories this weekend. There are only real victories against Ole Miss.
Yeah, Bielema really started his tenure in quicksand when he went 0-4 in conference play his first year as head of the Razorback program. Morris has a chance. And look back at Bielema's last three games in his first year at Arkansas, lost by a combined 21 points. You have to take advantage of these closer games down the stretch. I'm not saying you got to somehow get to bowl eligibility. I'm not saying you got to win five of the next six. But you need to win a couple of these conference games. And it's not like the slate of schedule is just daunting. Your SEC foe year after year is Missouri. And I know they won the SEC championship the first 2 years, but there's a lot harder teams like a Florida, like a Georgia. Georgia's just a top dog right now under Kirby Smart. There could be a lot worse opponents that you have to play year after year. And you get Vanderbilt. And then next year you're going to get Kentucky, I believe. So it's not like the schedule is just impossible to overcome.
That's you a have, Kentucky without Benny Snell,
yeah,
too, by the way.
Exactly. So you got to take advantage. I know it's your first year, Chad Morris, but you got to take advantage of the easier schedule you're going to be faced, especially getting Ole Miss at the defensive side of the football that they're at right now. I know that there's going to be a decent crowd there for Ole Miss being so close to Oxford, Little Rock, that location, but you got to win this week because all these moral victories that fans and listeners have been ripping us about that we've just pointed out, they're all for nothing if you don't win this week, and they're all for nothing if you don't win out, not win out. They're all for nothing if you don't find some success these last few games. Not success morally. I'm talking W's, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking three wins in the next 3 weeks. These are most definitely winnable games. And I don't think, you know, Coach Morris will say that even against, you know, Auburn or against Alabama, a loss is a loss. Not winning is unacceptable. These next 3 weeks, you got to win. You really do. In order to continue feeling, I think, like you are taking steps forward.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast. Follow the guys on Twitter at Phil Elson PXP and at Ty Sports Radio.
And it's Joe Adams with a hurdle. Great speed. Adams down the sideline. He's gone. 92 yards for a touchdown.
And at this time of the week, we are going to try to change my mind.
I changed my mind. Hi,
Joey. Hey, how you doing?
He won't sell anybody out to buy his future.
How can you be so obtuse?
What did you call me?
Obtuse. Is it deliberate?
Son, you're forgetting yourself.
Change my mind.
So I don't know how many folks watch Arkansas State football. There was some talk early in the season when ASU was ranked 25th in the country in the preseason polls. I forget which poll it was located in, but they were definitely ranked 25th. And on the short list of possible champions out of the Sun Belt, but Arkansas State has dropped their last two games. They lost 35-9 last night up in Jonesboro against Appalachian State. You know, we usually wouldn't bring up the Red Wolves, but there was so much conversation way before the season started about what would happen if Arkansas were to play Arkansas State in football. And I feel, Ty, like that conversation really kicked into high gear after the Arkansas baseball schedule was released. And for the first time, you had Little Rock, you had UAPB, and then all of a sudden you hear all the folks talking about, when are they going to schedule Arkansas State? When's that going to happen in football specifically? And they thought if it happened this year that the Red Wolves would beat the Razorbacks. You know what? I don't think that would happen now. Maybe it would have happened week one, week two, week three. Look to the second half of the season and what we are now expecting, I think, from Arkansas, certainly these next 3 weeks. I would hope that Arkansas beats Tulsa better than the Red Wolves did. Red Wolves went into Tulsa, won 29-20. I would expect to see a bigger discrepancy in the final score between the Razorbacks and the Golden Hurricane. But I don't think if you put these teams on the same field right now, Ty, I don't think Arkansas State wins that ballgame. I think Arkansas would win and may win handily. I don't know what kind of a line you'd put on it, but I think the Hogs would beat the Red Wolves. Change my mind.
Oh, the whispers have died down, Phil, because now Arkansas State has not been good. And notice how no one's saying, oh, if Arkansas State played Arkansas, they'd win. Notice how that doesn't happen when one of two things happen. When Arkansas State starts losing or when the Razorbacks are really good. Did you ever hear of an Arkansas State fan back in 2010 or 2011 talking about, hey, we could come down to Fayetteville and beat the Razorbacks? Did you ever hear that? No, you didn't.
No, not once.
Because it's not feasible. It wouldn't have happened then, and it's not going to happen now. So, yes, those rumors, those whisperings have dwindled down, and there's good reason for that. Phil, I can't change your mind.
No, I think it's impossible to change my mind there. Hey, look, and you know, here's the thing. Appalachian State's a pretty good football team. I think Georgia State or Georgia Southern, those are the two teams that the Red Wolves have lost to recently, but those are good Sun Belt teams. And I doubt that they'd be able to put up over 30 points against Alabama. Hey, Arkansas State only scored 7 against Alabama, and the Hogs put up over 30 against them. So, yeah, I didn't expect you to even try to change my mind with that first one. So why don't you give it a whiff right here?
All right, we'll go to the one I have third list on my list first, as I think it's the most relevant as of now. The Red Sox beat the Yankees, closed them out in the ALDS last night, and there was champagne in the locker room. And I get this is a rivalry game. I get that Aaron Judge was talking a little smack, and I get that there is a lot of hatred between these two programs. Not programs, two franchises. But, Phil, I do not like seeing champagne popped for making the playoffs, winning the ALCS. Excuse me, we're winning the ALCS. If it's the ALCS or the NLCS, I am kind of okay with that because you get to World Series. But I'm still just iffy on it. I am really only okay a popping champagne when you win the World Series. It's my generation's, everyone gets a trophy. There's no chasing championships, it seems like, anymore. I don't understand. I get you won an important series. Like, I get that. It's a rival. I get that. It's not just the Red Sox that did it. I just don't know if it should be celebrated like a championship should be celebrated. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think that NBA teams do that when they go to the final. Now, I could be wrong. I haven't seen highlights, and I haven't seen NFL teams do that as well. Now, when you win a championship, do whatever you want. I don't really care. That's fine. You
pour boiling oil on each other's heads, right?
That's fine. I don't really care. But I'm just not a fan of winning championship series or winning divisional series and then doing that. What are your thoughts on that? Change my mind, Phil Elson.
All right, a couple of things could be. Now, first of all, we don't know exactly what kind of champagne the Red Sox were popping last night. I would hope it wasn't the expensive stuff since it's not a championship series or a World Series win.
You think they're giving $9 bottles?
It is a Major League Baseball team. It is New York. It is Boston. So, I mean, they've got enough money to buy, you know, maybe a $49,000 bottle of Dom Perignon and dump it on their manager's head. But I think for a division series, if you're going to pop a bottle, it should probably be something like, oh, I don't know, Bud Light. And that used to be what they popped and they dumped on each other's heads back in the day. It was cans of beer. It was bottles of beer. And they didn't dump anything on anybody's head for just making the playoffs. I think before you got to the championships, before the divisional era began. I don't know. Maybe they dump in six bottles of Brut on each other's heads. But I agree with you in this case. I think, and I've hated the thought of teams that just clinch a playoff spot without clinching a division when they celebrate getting into the wild card game. But that's a one-game thing. That's a one-game thing. All you're doing is celebrating the idea that you're going to have a chance to play one more game, perhaps. I think there can be a little over-celebrating as well when it comes to the champagne. But, you know, when a division series, I can see it. To me, it's okay to dump some champagne on your teammates' heads. But I wouldn't go with the real good stuff.
So you're going the millennial route. You're saying it's okay.
I'm saying it's all right that at least it's not... A wild card win? No, I don't think that's champagne worthy. Clinching a playoff berth, it's not a divisional title, not playoff worthy. But here's the thing. Divisional titles are real achievements. That's a 162-game achievement. That's worth a celebration. For the wild card, not so much. Okay. For the division series, I can see it, but it better not be, you know, a $500 bottle of champagne. Make it the cheap stuff, or just, you know, dump water on your friends' heads.
Speaking of pouring beer on managers' heads, this got topped in our group text the other day. My friend is a year younger than us, had his 21st after all of us did, and I decided to start the trend of just pouring my beer on his head after a turn. And we're just at a bar, and we're outside of this bar, and I just start pouring, and everyone pour their drinks on him. And so he just gets, on his 21st, when you're supposed to have a really fun night, he's just covered from head to toe in alcohol, and he was not happy. Not happy at all.
I've been a part of a couple of clubhouse celebrations when I was working for the Travelers. Now, I would expect that clubhouse celebrations in professional baseball are a little bit different than they are in college baseball, because I did go into the locker room after Arkansas clinched the Super Regional against South Carolina, and let's just put it this way. It didn't smell like booze. It didn't smell like liquor. It didn't smell like champagne. It didn't smell like anything. It just smelled like the clubhouse usually smells. But then in the 2008 Texas League season, I was part of two big clubhouse celebrations. One was a winner-takes-all game to win the first half. Travelers had a huge comeback in extra innings, and that set off a wild clubhouse celebration, which included sliding on the floor and having beer and champagne dumped on our heads. It was memorable, highly memorable, and it's amazing that I was actually able to remember anything about that. Now, I don't remember what happened after the clubhouse celebration, because that was a whole other level. The actual celebration in the locker room itself was something that I do remember most of the details.
I'm of the mindset that if Arkansas wins a national championship, the drinking age should be changed to 18 just for one night.
At least for a night or two.
Yeah, at least for a night or two, because it's not going to get followed, so you might as well change the law for at least one night.
One way or the other, you're either drinking to celebrate or you're drinking to drown your sorrows.
Exactly.
And I've experienced it on both ends, including the sorrows, just a few months ago. All right. We'll keep it on the beverage thing here. And I there's no way that I'm the only person to say this. And in this day, everybody seems to really love coffee. It's on everybody's social media profile. It's become part of the cult. I mean, coffee's been part of the culture for a few centuries now, but I just feel like it's ticked up to a brand new level. That and the craft beer craze. Everybody seems to love craft beer. I think coffee is the best beverage on earth, and I don't think it's even close. And I'm someone who will imbibe any of the other nighttime beverages that I think some of our listeners may enjoy. I'm a water guy. You know, I really do like, I will drink a lot of water during the day. I'm not somebody that thinks that milk is just for kids, but I do think that coffee is the best beverage on earth, and it ain't even close. And here's the proof to me. If you were to remove coffee from the beverage list available to the entire world, I think you would see a lot more wars fought. I think you would have. I do. I think there would be a lot more angry people. I think that there would be a lot of slights that were taken that weren't meant that way. I think the anger would be boiling up. All we need in life is a little coffee to get you set for the rest of your day. And here I am doing a radio show with a dude who don't even drink coffee. So go ahead, non-coffee drinker. Change my mind.
Well, I wake up every morning at 4:30, and I typically don't shower in the morning, so I shower the night before. So occasionally will that do use that if I'm just so exhausted I have to get something to wake me up. But I know my teeth won't look as white if I drink it. I'm not. I do like coffee. I don't
You're
like
in radio.
Coffee.
Who cares? You got teeth made for radio. It's okay.
I got a face for radio too. That's what my friends say. But I just I've stayed away from it because I know it's not the best thing for you. And I'm not going to defend it and say it doesn't taste good because I like a good frappuccino. I like some good mixtures of coffee. But I think it's just water, man. I've never not wanted water. Now, there's times I want a soda. There's times I want an alcoholic beverage. But I've never passed up water. I know people who do not like water, that will not drink water.
Oh, my father. I got two people at the top of my list. One is a guy who works for the Travelers who says that he's got this is how he says, his name's Reggie, who said, I got to have something with flavor. He had to have something. Water doesn't have any taste, right? And then there's my father. And my father won't drink water because he says that's where fish go to the bathroom. And I'm thinking to yourself, well, what do you think the rest of your beverages are made of, dude? Made of water.
Water.
Fish went into the bathroom there as well.
Exactly.
Go ahead and don't drink anything for the rest of your life.
I don't know if I'll be able to change your mind. I know that's more of a north, because Dunkin' Donuts up north, they have one on every block because the coffee is so good.
It's ridiculous. It's a religion.
I know you, back when you were in Pittsburgh, you probably went there all the time. And there's, I mean, Starbucks is a big thing here. I can remember in college of how long that line would be when I was there. So it's not the best. Water's the best, Phil, but I don't think I'm changing your mind on this.
There's a study here. It's a British study. It was published on CNBC over the summer. Drinking as many times. You need this, okay? Remember, I'm older. I'm a little wiser. I'm trying to get you to live a full life.
IQ drinking, too.
Drinking as many as 8 cups of coffee a day could help you live longer, this study says. 500,000 British adults, coffee drinkers, were found to have slightly lower risk of death over a 10-year follow-up period than non-coffee drinkers. I love that. It's a very general way of just dying. Lower risk of death by drinking coffee. Unless you're walking on a freeway, then drink all the coffee you want. Ain't going to help you. What's your second one?
Second one. So beautiful people always stay winning. And there's certain, I have certain friends that are more attractive, guys and girls. And they just luck into everything, it seems like. I remember when I was in Nashville, one of my buddies, we had just eaten, and he's like, I'm going to give me a free milkshake, because he forgot to order one. He's like, and he entices the cashier, and I've never seen this before in my entire life, Phil. Just because he's a good-looking dude, he somehow gets a free milkshake, just for being nice, being attractive. And it's like, I have to put all this effort in when I go talk to a girl, and then I have some friends that literally can say dumb things, and it just works. And it's the same for girls, too. Like, you're beautiful, you're pretty, and just go up to a guy and just say whatever, and they'll just whatever. Beautiful people always stay lame. So we do not have that fortune, Phil. We do not at all. Or you might. I don't.
You sound a little envious.
Oh, yeah. I'm 100% envious. Yeah,
also,
absolutely.
It sounds like I don't know how much confidence you got in your own looks.
Well, no. Here's the thing. I would describe myself as a 6 or 7, slightly above average looking dude. Good hair, bad facial hair, as we've discussed. But there's difference between Matthew McConaughey and me. Like, I could go into a lot of other actors and actresses that are just, they're better looking. And it's beautiful people. Life comes easier than Phil. Tell me I'm wrong. Change my mind.
All right. I've got one example for you. And his name is Willie McGee.
Willie McGee.
Played outfield mostly for the St. Louis Cardinals throughout the 80s. With the Oakland Athletics a little bit. And I don't say this with any animosity towards him at all, but I've met Willie McGee. He was very friendly, and he was one of my favorite players of the 80s, but he was also one of the ugliest guys in the history of Major League Baseball. And he was a former MVP, batting champion. I heard it described once that Willie McGee looked like somebody was holding some poo under his nose.
Oh, my gosh.
That was a full-on description of what it's not what I described that he looked like, but it's what others had described that he looked like. He looked a lot older than he really was. And he, to me, probably would be one of the better examples. Bartolo Colon's another example, too, of an ugly guy who's made good and still pitching, and everybody loves him. Everybody loves him. Bartolo Colon doesn't have to buy a drink anywhere he goes. People know who he is. That's Bartolo Colon. Look how big he is. Get him another drink. Get him a second drink. Get him a third. It looks like he could use it.
Oh, man, the uphill battles of not being physically gifted.
Give yourself some time. Give yourself some time, and those looks will come exactly where they want, where you want them
we'll
to come.
We'll see. I'm trying to look refined like you, Phil, with the facial hair. We've been over this. I'm going to keep going.
You need the gray. You're
going
to need a silver Sharpie and to color that thing in a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. So now what we've previewed, I think, for the last week, War Memorial Stadium, I think, is a great place to watch football. It's not the most comfortable place. It's not the place that you go for great concessions. It's not the place that you go to watch the video board. It's not where you go to sit in a suite. It ain't even where you go to watch a video board that's operating properly, apparently, or a press box elevator that makes it all the way to the top more often than not. But it is a great place to watch a football game. The sight lines are second to none. I think the sight lines are better than they are at the Razorback Stadium. You're a little closer to the field. It's a football stadium that is designed for what football stadiums used to be designed for, which was watching the game specifically and no other reason. I mean, that's a fact when it comes to War Memorial Stadium. The only reasons to go there are either to complain about War Memorial Stadium or to watch the game and get a darn good view of that game at the same time. Change my mind.
Look, I've been to Miracle on Markham 1, been to Miracle on Markham 2, saw LSU game 2010, been to some great games down there. A lot of my great childhood memories were down in War Memorial Stadium. And you know what? They were good back then. But they really haven't done much to improve the amenities there. Bathrooms aren't that nice. Seats aren't that nice. I'm not going to defend you saying it's closer to the field, because it's closer to the field. And it's tight. It's compact. About, what is it, 52, 54? I'm blanking on the exact number.
About that, yeah. Yeah.
So it in that terms, and it's loud. Like Mike Leach was saying, it gets loud. It's nice and concrete. It is rocking when Arkansas is good. There's no denying that. But what we're trending towards overall for fandom, what fans want, is quality amenities, quality concessions, quality bathrooms.
We've become soft.
We've become soft
as sports fans.
100%.
Look, who needs a comfortable bathroom? Go to the bathroom before you show up, for crying out loud.
Exactly. And that's not me. I'm not trying to defend me here, Phil. I'm just saying the overall fan experience does not hold a candle compared to Donald W.'s Reynolds Razorback Stadium.
But it's a different experience.
It is.
It shouldn't be the same.
It should be
less comfortable.
You're right.
And
why should it be less comfortable?
Because it's a different stadium, and it's never gonna have that comfort level.
Like,
they're never gonna put the money into it. I wish they would have.
You like being in the mud, don't you? I love swirling around in it, don't you?
I love old ballparks. I love old stadiums.
What about Baum? You call games in Baum Stadium, if not the nicest stadium in college baseball. Are you going to hate on Baum? Are you going to say that they should hurt Baum and destroy the experience there?
No, but there are also improvements to be made at Baum Stadium. I mean, that's why they're building. That's why they're putting new things up. I could be critical of that stadium if I had to.
Pretty easily, too.
Look, you give me an opportunity to be critical about a ballpark, and I can.
What can you be? Don't spend more than 30 seconds on this. What is critical about Baum Stadium?
Entrances. It's a great ballpark, don't get me wrong, but you're asking me to be critical here, and so I will. The entrances need to be dressed up a little bit. They did finally, 2 years ago, putting an Arkansas Razorbacks over the main logo, but I think those wrought iron gates blend in more than they stand out. And so, for me, that's the top of my list there. What they did get in the new video board in there a couple years ago, that was huge. And then here's the other part of it. We need new broadcast booths. We need new press box, because they're very, very small compared to the rest of the SEC. So, I mean, there it would be my top critique of Baum Stadium, which it is the best ballpark in college
baseball.
It's
unbelievable. And it's just awesome. It's fantastic. All right, my last one real quick. Don't want to go too heavy into this. But in today's climate, and it's not just with politics, it's with a lot of different things, you don't have to have an opinion on anything. Do you know why you and I don't talk politics on the show and we talk other stuff on the show? We can talk pop culture occasionally, have fun.
Well, it's a sports show.
It's a sports show. And I can't speak to your capacity of knowledge when it comes to politics. I don't know enough to talk to you about Supreme Court, anything political. That's why you don't see me talking about that, because I don't know. So when you have, and it's both sides, it's not just a right issue, it's not just a left issue, But when you have different celebrities come out, and there's some, I'll admit, that are very well educated, that have done their research, that know their stuff, that have an esteem opinion about certain things.
And then there's everybody else,
and
you know, the other 90%.
So if you don't know what you're talking about, don't talk about it. You don't have to have an opinion on something just because it's in the news or it's just coming out. That doesn't mean you have to have it. You just say, I don't know enough on the matter. You ask me something about politics, Phil, in the next week or so, I'm going to say, sorry, Phil, I'm not going to answer that because I don't know enough on the matter. Change my mind. Should celebrities just go out and ramble about politics or whatever else just because they have an opinion and just because they have a following? Please change my mind about that.
Well, Ty, you know what they say about opinions, right? People have opinions and something else. We're all in common. They got opinions and something that starts with an A. And people are going to refer to both of them. So there's absolutely no way you can tell people to stop voicing their opinion. You can just, you know, close your ears a little bit or close your eyes and not listen or not see what those opinions are. So I can't change your mind that people shouldn't have opinions, but I can't agree with you that they might. And this isn't just politics, too. It's sports. It's religion. It's a lot of different things. One of the things that makes us so interesting as a race, as a human race, is that we disagree. We converse about it. The level of the conversation, though, to me, is what has changed over the last 25 to 30 years, even in sports where, we kind of have that same almost like a negative tilt to the way the conversation is held sometimes. So, I mean, that's one thing I don't think we do on this show. We're a little friendlier, I think, than some of the other places where the sports talk turns into vitriol.
Yeah, it's discourse becomes really, really aggressive. It's not, I have opinions, but I don't voice them because, again, I don't know enough about it to be voicing all this stuff. So that's just my take on that.
Subscribe to the show on iTunes. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
Trying to extend the play and throw Solis. Pick six. Will it be? Yes. How about that?
We're right to the hotline. Every Wednesday at this time, we talk college football with Bill King, outstanding radio host from Nashville Sports Radio. Bill, how are you this week?
Hey, guys. Doing very good. Thank you.
Always appreciate you coming on with us. We'll get right into it here. And I want your opinion on the Arkansas performance against Alabama, because there, you know, Nick Saban was not very happy with his defense. You know, if there is an Achilles heel for the Alabama Crimson Tide, it's defense. But Arkansas puts up 31 points against them, the most that Alabama's allowed since the 2016 college football playoff. And my question to you is, does that say more about the Arkansas offense or about the Alabama defense right now?
Let me say this, and I'm pretty sure this is not an original thought on your show, but somewhere in that A&M game, I kind of felt like Arkansas took a nice little turn. Now, they're not personnel-wise ready to make much of a dent in the West yet, but I thought the team took a turn for the best, and it looks like they're playing better relative to where they were. And I think some of that is expected because you've got a brand new situation with Chad Morris and new thinking, new theories, all that. But I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think Chad Morris is one of the best offensive minds in college football. He's proven that year after year, dating back to Tulsa all the way to Clemson. And I think some of it is, as good as Alabama is on offense, and we may be talking about epic levels of good, defensively they aren't up to where they typically are. And they just lost Trevon Diggs, and it doesn't sound very good on him. So there's a DB in an area where they were kind of vulnerable anyways. And the backup is a guy that is a liability. And their linebackers, a couple of their linebackers have not played well this year, including the former number one ranked player in America, Dylan Moses, and also Mac Wills. So they've got some issues. I don't know if it's enough, though, for them to lose a ball game. Matter of fact, right now, I don't think it is.
So that leads into to my next question, which isn't necessarily about, you know, who would win in a matchup of Alabama and Georgia, because I think we'll be talking about that once you come to the end of the month of November. But the way that Georgia is playing on both sides of the ball, and their defense looks like it's the best in the SEC, offensively, they're also very good. Is there a chance, is Georgia, although they're ranked second in the country, is there a chance that Georgia is a more complete team overall than Alabama is?
If that means the outcome of the game, no. Because I think the offense that Alabama has to basically limitless wide receivers, basically limitless running backs, and an offensive line, which is the best in the league, I don't think George beats them right now. Now, again, balance-wise, are they more complete? I think that's probably a decent debate. But as it applies to winning the game, I don't think today Georgia would beat Alabama. Now, again, you guys understand, and we talk about it a lot, a month and a half from now, maybe we've got a different conversation. 2014, Ohio State lost to Virginia Tech at home. Turns out Virginia Tech wasn't even any good. And Ohio State won the national championship. So you never know how things switch. 2 years ago, I saw Ohio State go to Norman, Oklahoma, and beat Oklahoma and Baker Mayfield badly on a Saturday night in Norman. At that time, I said, that team right now wouldn't lose to Alabama. That team right now would not lose a game to anybody else in America. And it turns out that after that, they didn't play so well. So you never know.
Bill Keane's our guest. You can follow him on Twitter at Bill is Keane's college football guru. Bill, UCF has not lost since 2016. They got South Florida and Cincy at the end of their season. Is there any scenario that you can see them squeak into the college football playoff?
This sport is so chalky. Probably not. Now, it would have to take a lot of chaos. It would probably require Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Notre Dame, all losing regular season games, maybe a couple of them, two games, for them to get the notoriety they would need. I think, and again, the sport is so chalky that I don't think that is, at least at the moment, realistic.
Chad Morris looks like he's going to pull off a top 15 recruiting class before it's all said and done. Who's the best recruiter that you've seen at a middle-tier school like Arkansas?
Wow. That's a very good question. Hugh Freeze? Probably.
That's solid.
Now, we may want to question how they got those guys. But
we know how they got it, Bill. I remember you calling that hotline when I was back working with you. We know how they got them.
Right. So, probably. I mean, recent memory. And I think, regardless of some of the cheating, he's really good at it. By the way, I'm hearing his name a lot of places. I don't know if it's realistic, but come help Gus. Come help Jeremy Pruitt. I've heard his name. He may be somebody's coordinator pretty prominently next year.
With that being said, I've heard some things about – he actually came to the Little Rock Touchdown Athletic – or the Little Rock Touchdown Club, and he was talking – someone asked him a question, is Greg Sankey blackballing you? And he didn't – exactly hit it head on. Do you think there's any way that Greg Sankey, SEC commissioner, is blackballing Hugh Freeze from getting a job in the SEC?
I think he did originally with Alabama. I don't think it's a forever blackball. I think that was too soon. I think if somebody makes a run at him, SEC team needing a spurt on their offense or something, I don't think he would stand in the way now. But I do think originally, I'm positive, he was a big problem for Alabama to clear him. Yes.
Bill Keane joining us. He's a sports host on Nashville Sports Radio, WSNR in Nashville, and on with us every Wednesday at this time to talk college football. The Florida Gators have bounced back very well since that loss to the Kentucky Wildcats, upset LSU. Great defensive performance. This defense right now looks like it is the real thing. And a couple of weeks, I mean, they get Vanderbilt, and then a bye week, and then they get UGA, and then you'll really see how good that Florida defense is or isn't.
Correct. They're not as balanced as Georgia. Georgia's got a several-year head start on them and good quality recruiting. That defense is better than I thought. I thought this year might be the year where they couldn't even depend on the defense. Because that's been the one constant. Through Muschamp's debacle, through the McElwain situation, they played outstanding defense that whole time. I thought they may give a little sum back to the marketplace, if you know what I mean, this year. They've been salty, man. They have been physical. They play well on every level. And I think more remarkable, though, because we've always taken the defense for granted there at Florida, is Pal McElwain has somehow settled down that offense. Now, they're not incredibly explosive or anything, but they are well coached now. And the play they're getting at quarterback is at least solidifying. It's not spectacular. It's limited, but it's actually somewhat productive. They're running back heavy. They do have a few playmakers at wide receiver from time to time. But I think he's done a remarkable job. And a lot of people were – I know the Gator fans were really upset after the Kentucky game, really not knowing how to measure that. All they knew was they hadn't lost to Kentucky since the mid-80s. That's all that mattered about that. Turns out Kentucky's pretty good. Just lost the ball game, but they're pretty good. And it turns out that Florida is very much improved since that Kentucky game. I know you don't get to reschedule teams you lost to, but I don't think Kentucky would beat Florida if they played today.
Fair to say, Georgia, LSU, biggest game in the SEC, maybe the biggest game in college football this weekend. And what do you expect to see there?
Yeah, I think the biggest game so far that's been played is Ohio State and Penn State. But Georgia LSU's got a lot of meaning. And this is probably an elimination because LSU's not going to beat Alabama. And if Georgia goes down there and win, which they're about an 8-point favorite to do so, LSU can still have a good year. But again, I don't think there's any way they're going to beat Alabama. It might be a tight game, but I don't think they win the ball game. So then you're talking about 9-3-ish. And then if you lose another one, let's say you lose to the Aggies or somebody like that, you're 8-4, then people start complaining a little bit again. It is at LSU, and that's a significant advantage, getting to play there in that environment. But Georgia's better. I think Georgia's got more playmakers. So I think it's going to take a lot of help from Georgia for LSU to pull this ball game off.
Bill Keane's our guest. Bill, you ever been to War Memorial Stadium?
I have not. I have not been there, no.
Okay, so question kind of to go off that. I know Alabama and Auburn used to play in Birmingham. There's not a top-tier college football program that I can think of at the moment that plays one of their home games in another city inside of the state. I could be wrong, but I can't think of one at the moment. Do you think that's smart for Arkansas to continue to play games in Little Rock, taking away a game from Fayetteville?
Boy, now, I'm not in that state like you guys, so I don't think I'm nearly as qualified to be an in-state product and say, okay, here's where it's at, everybody. But to me, when I think of Little Rock, I think of Arkansas territory. It might not be your Fayetteville campus home facility, but it's still a home facility for you. So I don't think that's selling out or hurting. I really have not had a problem.
Bill, what's the best college football venue you've ever been to? I know you've been to a lot of them.
Well, I mean, I've been to almost all of them. I've been to – you know what's interesting about LSU? I've been to LSU at night several times. But every time I'm there, they're down. I don't know, just the timing of the trip, you know, it's usually an advanced thing. And then I get in there, and when they're down, their fans are no different than anybody else. They're not that passionate. When they're beat down and it's kind of sucky and they don't – come out in the anger and the fervor that they do when they're really, really good. So, but that would be one of them. I would say several in the South. But let's get out of the South because we always throw those in. Happy Valley is incredible. The Shoe is incredible. The Big House is incredible. There's probably more big facilities, well, at the top there are, in the Big Ten than the SEC. I'd say a lot of those rock pretty good. And let me tell you something. Penn State on a Saturday night is just as intimidating and just as loud as anything we've got in the SEC.
But so much of it, Bill, don't you feel, and you're even saying it about how, you know, going to LSU when they were down and the atmosphere
right.
Wasn't the same. It's like I'd like to see a UCLA game at the Rose Bowl, just not this year because they stink. And you kind of feel the same way about maybe Neyland Stadium in Tennessee. So much of the atmosphere at a college football game just has so much to do with how well the home team is performing and how those fans feel about that team.
Right. And the Rose Bowl is such a big facility that it's very rarely filled, even when they're good. It's very rarely filled. Maybe when you've got Southern Cal, UCLA, something like that. But it's typically not going to be. Once you get out there, now Outson Stadium is that way, absolutely that way. UW, their on Lake Washington is another one that's really, really a good home field. Most of those out there aren't really. I mean, you're right. It's all about how good you are as a team.
Yeah, Mike Leach was actually talking about Autzen Stadium last year, and he actually said War Memorial is the loudest stadium he's ever been in because of the concrete structure. It sounds like there's 250,000 people in there. He had McElroy on the broadcast on Saturday said Donald W. Reynolds Razorback Stadium is the loudest atmosphere he's ever played in. He said that after the 2010 game where he threw two picks. I know it's been a while, Bill, but what's your memory like of going to a game in Razorback Stadium?
I was there a bunch, seems like in the 90s, and I didn't see it that way. Now, again, I wasn't thinking along those lines at the time about how loud this is comparatively speaking, but I was there a couple times, once in the early 90s, really early former. It's either 94, 95, and it was a very good game. Tennessee somehow pulled it out, but it was a close game. And I thought it was a fantastic location and stadium, but it didn't stand out to me. It's probably just the circumstances or the environment at the time, though.
Bill, we always appreciate you coming on with us. We'll cut it there, and looking forward to having you on with us next week. Enjoy the games on Saturday.
Okay, boys. Thank you.
Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.